We open the evening with a moment of silence, followed by...
Good evening, folks. My name is Norm, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm certainly happy to have the opportunity to be here tonight and participate. And I want to thank Jane and Glenn and the entire committee for the opportunity to be here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you folks that I can come by another day myself. And to welcome all of the new people. I was surprised when they asked for new people and there were no new people to raise their hands. You know, this time of year we get a lot of new ones coming in. This is the last of the Christmas holdouts you're starting to get here about now. Down home we get a deluge of people coming in. But for the people that may be here new tonight, if you will, try to keep an open mind on what you can use. Why, take it with you, and if you can't use it, kick it under the chair and leave it there. I'm sure you've got a lot of meetings here, which gives you the opportunity to get out and get to a lot of meetings in Fresno before you make any decisions about your program or about Alcoholics Anonymous in general. And you will, if you will, please try to remember that anything I might say here tonight are going to be things that I personally believe in. It's going to be what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous means to me. It's going to be some things that I've used to stay sober over a period of time. But I'm not by any stretch of the imagination an authority or a consultant on the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an example, good or bad, that AA works. That it has been necessary for me to take a drink, steal anything, or go to jail now for 2 weeks, 11 months, and 27 years. I thought that up. I really didn't think anybody would be impressed. I am, obviously. I never brought it up. And I've been talking about it for years. You know, I keep thinking we're going to get a pension program going here in AA, and if we do, God, I want to get credit for all my time. But to the new guy that's sitting out here tonight, it's a difficult thing to digest when you hear people stand up here and talk about, you know, periods of sobriety. And I can relate to that. I can recognize what he's going through because I can still remember sitting there in that first AA meeting, and I hope to hell I never forget. I'm sitting there, and I'm 29 years old at the time. I'm 57. You can always tell a guy trying to figure it out, but saves a lot of calculation, all that crap. Anyway, I'm sitting there, and I'm 29 years old, and the guy stands up in front of the meeting that night, and he says, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, steal anything, or go to jail now for 9.5 years. And my reaction to him was the same as all new people. You know, I wanted to go outside and throw up. I sat there and thought, you know, 9.5 years? Jesus, he's the biggest liar I've ever heard. Well, how the hell could a guy go 9.5 years out there in that rotten jungle and not drink? And I hadn't come to AA for 9.5 years. Who did? I came to AA for a little while. I think we all did. I came in here to get the heat off. I had a lot of heat on out there in the street, and I wanted to get the heat off. I wanted to get back out and get going because alkies are busy people, right? I had a lot moving, and I wanted to get out there before it was gone. You know how that is. And I had a lot of my friends out there that were waiting for my arrival. My best friends. I couldn't think of their names, but they were my best friends. I was deeply concerned about their well-being. I was afraid, you know, who's there to guide them? They'll die. You know, I almost rationalized myself right out the door and back into them gin mills, but I kept going to meetings. And I went to meetings because my sponsor said, you got to go to meetings. And I didn't like my sponsor. And I knew he thought that I couldn't go to a lot of meetings, and so I went to a lot of meetings. You see, and if I'm going to say anything tonight that may be significant, it's you got to go to meetings. And I don't care whether you've been around for 28 days or 28 years. You know, without any meetings, it's very difficult to function out there on the street. And you see, this last year, for example, five friends of mine, two of them with 16 years, one with 18 years, one with 24 years, one with 26 years, and they're all out there drinking. And they all have the same thing in common. They haven't been to meetings now for a long, long time. So for me, without the meetings, why, it's very difficult to function. If I'm going to hold any semblance of sanity and serenity, keep any peace of mind, if I'm going to keep it where it's supposed to be, I've got to have the equalizer, and the equalizer in my life is the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they know about me. They've got the answers to my problems. If I could have found the answers to my problems out there on that street, God knows I'd have still been out there, you see. But those people didn't have any of the answers, and I came in here, and they had the answers to my problems and to my questions. And when I was new, I had a lot of questions, and I kept wondering about the next 9.5 years and what the hell I was going to do. And they assured me that I needn't be concerned, that really all I had to take care of was right now, because that's all I had. And that's all I've got is right now. I couldn't change what happened a couple of hours ago. And I can't tell you for sure what's going down a couple of hours from now. If there's anything going in my life, it's going right now. And man, I better get all I can get right now. Good, bad, or indifferent, because it may not be through again, you see. Or maybe I'm not walking down that street one more time. And so I discovered a long time ago that if I'll just kind of take care of right now, that the balance will be all right. And I've been working that way now for almost 28 years. And it was really just the other day that I walked through the doors. It went, you know, that fast. The other day that I'm sitting there in those AA meetings, and I'm going through the same, you know, the mental gymnastics that all new people go through. I'm sitting there wondering, what am I doing in AA? You know, why am I an alcoholic? You know, all new people, I'm sure, sit there, why am I an alky? You know, Jesus, of all the things it could have been. Wasn't a vocation with any of us. I didn't go down to my high school counselor, and he said, Norm, what would you like to be? And I said, an alcoholic. And he said, marvelous, we got a hell of a program for jackasses, boy, yeah. And I took that program, and I ripped that city out there for 15 years, and I ended up in AA, and everybody lives happily ever after, and you know that, isn't it? And I sat there, and I wondered, you know, why am I an alcoholic? We got a million people in AA, we got a million answers to that question. Because the only thing a couple of alcoholics agree upon is the fact that AA works. Other than that, we're going to argue about everything else, so we're going to argue about what makes an alcoholic. And I felt initially that I'm alcoholic by virtue of my family. My people are Irish-Italian, first generation born in this country. Too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. Not overly intelligent, talked a lot with their hands. But they knew a hell of a lot about booze, I'll guarantee you that. They knew how to make it and drink it, and the Italians made it, and the Irish drank it, and I got to AA, and that's about the way it went down. Yeah. I felt at the beginning, you know, the people and the places and the things create all my problems and the trouble, my family, the environment. I'm a product of L.A., and anybody coming out of East L.A. had a problem. But East L.A. is a city, and you can get out of anywhere you want to get out of. If you want it bad enough, and you're willing to make some kind of sacrifices together to do it, you know it, and I know it. These things do not create alcohol. I don't think alcoholism. I'm alcoholic because I drank too much whiskey. And I figured that out by myself. What a giant decision that was, yeah. It was a whiskey I drank out there, and I drank that baby hard and fast. Yeah, and I crossed some invisible line out there. And I'm the guy that did the drinking, so when you get down to the bottom line, where's the problem? I'm the problem. Because no matter where I go, I'm the first guy to get there, right? And none of us had to call somebody up and say, will you come on down, man, and help me get it screwed up? No, I never had that trouble. I've been able to overreact to any situation, anywhere, anytime. I don't need any help out there. I'm not as bad today as I used to be, but I still revert back. I'm still a guy out there, you know, that I'm a rationalizer, a justifier, a compromiser, and I got a rotten attitude. I traveled half the world in half my life. I made a complete ass of myself. I spent money I didn't have buying things I didn't need, trying to impress people I didn't like. I sat around them gin mills and built the castles in the air and farmed the corporations. Talked in millions, spent in thousands, never had a five in my pocket. Drove them Cadillacs up and down the bar night after night after night. Yeah. And when them high rollers said, what do you do? I said, man, I do it all. I am the general manager of the universe. I thought you understood that. Yeah. The typical alcoholic that spends a lifetime out there impressing a group of people that he's never met in his life. And he'll never see again. And if he does see him, he can't remember what he was, huh? What a godsend it is when you walk through the doors into this program to come to find out that you don't have to be anybody anymore. I don't have to be as good as you or the guy down the street. All I got to be today is a little bit better than I was yesterday. That's all I have to do. I don't have to justify my existence or compromise my life if I don't want to. And if you're new here this evening, you might give it a little thought. You might buy the package that's available to you here. And you might take it with me tomorrow out there in that city street, and you might spend a day just being sober and being yourself, not having to justify or compromise. And that's as good a deal as you're ever going to get in your life. And I'm a guy that looked half the world out there trying to find the best deal, and I didn't find it, not until I got here. Not until I was surrounded by a marvelous group of people who would call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. So welcome to the new folks. And tonight to tell you just briefly a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. I told you a great deal. I'm a guy with a bad attitude, and if you got a bad attitude, you got a lot of trouble. Because life and living is a matter of attitude. You wake up in the morning, you got a rotten attitude. What's the day? It's a rotten day. Work at it, it'll go a week. Spread it out, you know, if you really put your mind to it, hell, you can go a whole month. I had a whole year out there in 1962, you know, but I worked at it, yeah. My bad attitude got me a lot of trouble. I got picked up the first time in 1939. When I say picked up, I'm talking about the police. I was picked up not for drinking, I'm too young, I'm stealing. I'm a thief by trade, I'm an alcoholic by absorption. I think that's the way I went down. That old priest told me years ago, he said, you know, that's what it is. And I guess that's what it was. I opened up my own business in 1936. I was the general manager and vice president of all the outside operations of the Midnight Auto Supply in the Auto Supply in Gable Valley. I was in the car business. I moved them cars. Stole them. Liked it. Best deal I ever had in my life. Best business I ever been in. You didn't need any money to get into it. You didn't carry any inventory, and everything you turned was 100% profit. How the hell are you going to beat that deal, huh? And there's an instantaneous exhilaration about it. And if you've never tried it, it's difficult to digest, to understand. And you know, when you hook the man's car and you're driving away and he's running after you, you know, that man, you get bang, that instantaneous exhilaration. Your heart jumps right up in your throat. You break out in a cold sweat, and for 10 seconds, man, you're livid. God, I get excited talking about it tonight, I'll tell you. God. But it's illegal. It's unfortunate. And so the inevitable. If you're going to play, you got to pay. And the old law of retribution, what's going out is coming back, and that's for sure. If you're going to mess around out there in that gray area, you're going to dabble. If you're going to compromise your life and your living, the steps of this program are the commandments as you understand them. Somewhere down the road, everybody goes to scratch. It's kind of sad. I don't particularly care for it, but that's the way it is. And I understood that a long time ago, but I didn't pay any attention. I went in front of a judge, and the judge was to send me out to the reformatory, and I was to spend some time out there. I got a release. I got put on probation. I came back into L.A. I'm looking for the fantasy land, I suppose, and the fantasy land I was trying to find was booze. And booze walked in, and it was in 41. It was Easter week in L.A. It was Balboa Beach and the Rendezvous Ballroom and Stan Kenton and Padre Beer, and it was a hell of a deal, man. We drank a little Padre, and we'd get a little buzz on. We'd go in that dance hall. We'd dance with them dollies. We'd act four times drunker what we were, and we'd breathe on them girls, or, you know, let them know, huh? Big man's in from L.A., baby, yeah. It was fun. I was not an alcoholic. I was not a born alcoholic. No, I had a pretty good time. It was a big band. It was a Trianon and a cotton club down in Culver City, and James and the Dorseys and the Kentons and the whole thing, and it was fun. But Padre Beer wasn't the answer to my problem, no. He didn't get any, he had to drink a lot to get a buzz going, so I moved from Padre, and I got into that Rainier Ale. And from the Rainier Ale, I moved into whiskey, and when I got the whiskey, there it was. To me, whiskey was the greatest thing made since money and girls, because that whiskey gets you downtown, man, and I want to be downtown, and I don't want to be downtown in a little while. I want to get there right now, and that's one thing about whiskey, boy. It gets your attention, doesn't it, yeah. The day came when I even liked the taste of whiskey. It took a little time, you know. When you're young and you're out there training, it's tough. I broke in on 10 high, and that crap's rotten, I'll tell you. If they made anything worse than 10 high, I never drank it, and I drank everything available, because I'm not a choosy drinker. A guy says to me, you want a drink? I said, let's go. Hell, I didn't stand around for a half an hour and have a long conversation with a guy about what the hell he's drinking, because I learned as a young man, the best whiskey you're ever going to get's yours, right? Sure, you keep the overhead down. I drank all kinds, but nothing was worse than that 10 high. Jesus, that it burned, gone, and coming. That, you know how it'll hit once in a while, comes back up on you. It run up my nose and made my eyes water a lot. But I hung in. I think that's important. You know, a guy's going to be an alcoholic. He doesn't give up because he throws up a little. You know? No, you stay in there. And the day comes when you can drink a pint of whiskey and you don't heave anymore. It kind of gives you a sense of well-being. You know? Now, the whiskey changed my personality. I started getting more trouble. And by the end of 41, I'm in a bad jam. I'm picked up by the probation department. They're going to violate me. But they get the opportunity to join the Navy. And so in January 1942, I joined the Navy. And I went in with a lot of aspirations. And I think they were things that I was sincere about. I thought, you know, I'll go in the Navy. My father agreed. And he says, yeah, you can straighten your life out. And you can finish your education. And I thought I might be the youngest lieutenant commander the Navy ever had. I had all kinds of good thinking, you know, and that lasted for about 2 weeks. You see, I went in a seaman in 1942, and 4 years later I came out a seaman. But and people said, well, that's impossible. But not really, you know. You put your mind to it, an alcoholic can do anything he wants to do, you see. Yeah. I've always reacted to authority, and the Navy was authority, and I had a lot of trouble. I was all right when I was aboard ship. I liked ships, and I liked the sea. I did a good job. Alcoholics are that way. You know, they're hard workers. They got to be. An alcoholic's got to work 25% harder than anybody else just to stay even out there. And the way it goes, he's You know, you're always coming from behind. You always got the heat on you. And when you're right, you got to give her hell. Tuesday's a good day for an alcoholic. He missed Monday. Bam, Tuesday, he goes. But when he's right, he goes. And I did a good job aboard ship. But when that ship pulled into port and I was on a beach, I got a lot of trouble. I had three court-martials. I had a debt summary, a general court. The general court-martial was the highest the Navy had to offer at that time. I got 11 and a half months in a Navy brig up there at the top of Goat Island, run by the Marine Corps. I did 70, 80-day solitary confinement on bread and water. I did some other miscellaneous things that aren't important. But all directed to booze. Now, I fulfilled a commitment. I discharged out on Christmas Eve of 45 and I came back to L.A. in 46. In 1946, I'm that alcoholic. In 1946, the invisible line I've crossed. I can't live with it and I can't live without it. One's too many and 1,000 aren't enough. I'm trying to find the answer to living out there in a quart of whiskey and I can't find it. My whole life revolves around booze. People that sell it and people that drink it. And a half a dozen, why, no control over my destiny. I am the alcoholic, but I don't recognize it. In 1946, it's kind of peculiar. You know, God moves in strange and mysterious ways. And no matter what you do or you don't do, it's going to work out that way anyway. In 1946, I was having a bad time in a town down south. It's a rotten town. It's called Pasadena. I was having trouble in Pasadena. Every time I turned around, I was getting picked up. I got picked up in my second 502. I go in front of the judge, and the judge says, a year suspended, 3 years probation, pay your fine, get out of here. As I'm walking out of the courtroom, I remember like yesterday, I'm saying to myself, self, don't drink in Pasadena. Now, you don't need to be overly intelligent to understand that, right? You're having a lot of trouble. That judge, you know, he means business. He's never lied to you in your life. If you come back to Pasadena, you're going to get drunk. He's going to get you. You're going to jail. And so I stayed out of town a couple of months. And then I'm sitting in the gin mill one night, and I must be 70 miles away. And I was drinking, and I committed the cardinal sin. I began to think. And an alcoholic should never do that. He should think or drink. Don't do them both. Oh, no, I got to thinking about Pasadena, yeah. I want to go back to Pasadena. I'm going back. It's a free country. And I'm a veteran, by God. And so I went back. Hell, obviously. I couldn't have been down 2 or 3 hours. And I'm totally smashed. And I remember that I met a buddy of mine. We was in a place called the Green Terrace. We're walking out. It must have been about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. We're getting my car. We're heading for Eagle Rock for an after-hours joint there. And the next thing I know, a car is making a left turn in front of me. And the next thing you know, I'm waking up in the morning. And I'm in the Slammer in Pasadena. Yeah, scared to death. Always scared to death, always living on the edge, always coming from behind. I go down in front of the judge, and the judge, he reads it, and he says, 501 felony, drunk driving, hit and run, bodily injury involved. And you know how your heart drops right down, and how you die 1,000 times. And he said, there's no place on the streets for people like you. And he turned to the man, and the man took me off. And in the city jail, I shared a cell with the guy going to AA, 1946. God moves in strange and mysterious ways, and no matter what you do or you don't do, it'll come to pass anyway. One guy got out of jail. One guy out of 200, 250 guys was getting out of the can once a week to go to these AA meetings, and that's my cell partner. That's the guy that planted the seed. Strange how it worked out. Now, I didn't go to any meetings with him. I remember him sitting there. You know, people would pick him up. You know, they'd take him to a meeting. AA didn't come to the jail at that time. And after one of the meetings, he'd sit around and he'd talk about the meeting, what had happened. He said, Norm, why don't you go to a meeting? You're in here because of drinking. And I remember like yesterday saying, Sully, I'm not going to no AA meeting. I'm no alcoholic. You know, I'm a heavy drinker. I'm having a lot of bad luck. I'm a victim of unusual circumstances and rotten drivers and bad whiskey, but I'm no alcoholic. I'm too young. I said, what the hell I get to be your age? You're over the hill, man. You're 36. What do you really got to look forward to? And I've eaten those words several times, I'll tell you that. But in that point in time, I thought, you know, it's a place to go when you got so old you couldn't do anything else. And he went out in his way, and I went mine. But I never forgot about him. And if I'm going to say anything tonight that might be important to the new people, like, that seed was planted. Now, I'd never been to any meeting, but that seed about AA, and a place to go for drinking. Now, you never forget about it. If there's any new people here tonight, and I hope the hell you don't have to, but if you go back out again, you're not going to forget about us. We're going to screw that drinking up. You're not going to have any fun out there anymore, you see. You're going to be sitting around and you're going to remember about us. And God willing, well, you'll come back to see us. God willing, you won't have to go back out. But that seed was there. And 8 years later, I got up off of the floor in February of 1954, and I was wondering about a buddy of mine named Sullivan that I'd shared a jail cell with in 1946 and whether he was still around. But it took those 8 years. I had to drink some whiskey in order to get qualified. I went to work at that time for one of the largest construction firms in the world. They were in the pipe business, the concrete pipe, and we drove a lot of tunnels in those days. It was owned and operated by three Yugoslavs that came from the old country. They made all their money with hard work and good whiskey. So you know I'm working for the right outfit at the right time. We had work going all through the 11 western states. And each and every time, you know, I'd pull into a new job with the responsibilities to get bigger and the money to get bigger, and man, I'm living. I'm drinking better whiskey, and I'm drinking it in better joints. I did have a little setback about that. I'd met and married a red-headed Irish woman, had a violent temper, a rotten disposition, yelled at me a great deal, and never recognized my sensitivity. If you're an alcoholic, you'll agree we are very sensitive people, right? Not only that, she was pregnant a great deal of the time, too. That was a terrible setback. My bar associates had told me, I remember sitting around the gin mills when we'd be talking about things of this nature, and they're giving this good advice about, now, man, don't marry a woman who hasn't got a job. My God, you're taking on an overhead. Have you, you know, you've got a woman with a decent job, well, you've increased your money. You know, you've got a double income. And about midnight, that makes sense. And Red had a hell of a job. Yeah, things were great. It's going good for about 2 months, maybe three at the outside. And I remember coming home one night, and she says, Norm, I've been to the doctor and I'm pregnant. And I've got to quit my job. And I couldn't believe what I was listening to. You ever tell an alcoholic something you don't want to believe? I don't want to believe that. I thought we ought to get a second opinion on that thing anyway, you know. And she told me that she was home free. You know, them Irish are pretty hard-headed. And she said, this way it's going to be. And I thought, well, what the heck? That isn't that bad a deal. That keeper takes about 9 months. We'll give her three, maybe, to get on her feet. We'll get that job back again. Everything's going to be just like it was. Is that the story of the alcoholic? Everything's going to be just like it was. Hell, that was 34 years ago, and that woman ain't turned a tap since that day. No. She got herself in that shape 8 times. It was incredible. I couldn't believe it. Every other year, zing, there she goes, you know. The Vatican roulette. Man, the number had come up 14 every other year. There she goes, you know. And that continual harassment. I'd be gone 2 or 3 days, and I'd come home. And I was extremely tired. Because I've been busy putting a lot of deals together. And when you walk in the house, you want to be met with a little love, affection, and understanding. Who the hell likes to be met with that cat? You're drunk again. She never even smelled my breath. She's standing 10 feet away. You're drunk again. What conversations we'd have. I say, who, me? Like 30 guys are with you. Yeah, you know who she's talking to, but you got to test her a little bit, right? And she'd say, yeah, you. And then I'd hit her with a big one. I'd say, baby, do you know who you're talking to? I'm old Norm. That's who the hell I am. And don't you ever forget that. You're trying to let her in on a hell of a deal, right? And then she'd mimic me as only the way them Irish women can do it. I'm old Norm. That's who I am. You know. God, that is so humiliating for a high roller, I'll tell you. Standing there with your new business partner. That's the fellow you met in the bar last night. You've asked him home. The reason he's coming home with me is, hell, he don't want to go home alone either, does he? No. He's scared of his wife. He's married to a short Italian woman. They're bad. And oh, there you stand, the blind leading the blind. No, you've embarrassed me in front of my best friend. And I couldn't think of his name. And then she'd tell me what I could do with old best friend. And then I'd say, baby, if that's the way you're going to be, well, I'm leaving. And I ain't never coming back. And this is different than all the other times, baby. Yeah. Oh, yeah, she'd go down, you know, pick up my clothes and just throw them out, right? Then you got to save face in front of your new friends or you got to pick the damn clothes up. Then you pack them out to the car, right? In and out, loading up that car. Oh, yeah. That old clothes-packing alcoholic is a joy to that neighborhood, I'll tell you. Beats the hell out of gun smoke every Saturday night, huh? Watching the old Elkie out there loading up his car. In and out, in and out. Sitting in the front seat, honking his horn. Honk, honk, honk. I'm gone, baby. Zoom off into the night goes the alcoholic. Never to return. 2 days later, you wake up in the front seat of your car. You're a car sleeper, huh? We got a lot of car sleepers in AA. That helped get you here, I'll tell you that. Having your head screwed up under the armrest and the door handle in your ear, huh? You're heaving straight up in the air and you can't get out. Did you ever wake up about midnight and you're sick and you think your window's down, it's up? Yeah. You knock the hell out of your head. And you heave on your window. And then you sit there and roll it down. Squish, squish, squish. Huh? And then you sit there and say to yourself, I wonder why I never roll it down before I throw up on it, I wonder. These are giant problems in the life of an alcoholic. And on the way home, you're met with another disaster. You have a flat tire. But you don't change it. Never. No self-respecting alcoholic who was a little drunk, he would change a tire. He might hurt himself. He drives on it because he knows everything disagreeable in his life will go away. And it does. It disappears. You're now driving on the rim. We have a lot of rim drivers in AA. The tire gets all chewed up, disappears. Here he comes, you know, rim driver coming home. Sparks are flying, neighbors are dashing out, getting the kids out. You pull the car into the driveway, up in the lawn, open the door, fall out, right? And you lay out on the lawn for a while so the neighbors may inspect you. There he is, yeah. And then the old Elkie gets up in an hour or so and he says to himself, I wonder if anybody saw me. Yeah. Because he's convinced that nobody knows he drinks. Well, I did all my boozing out there in them gin mills. I like the junk, you know, I like the bars. I like the dark lights and the rotten music. The intellectual giants I met there. Sitting there about midnight with that Maybelline look, you know, you kind of get wide-eyed. Sitting there looking in that mirror, you devil, you, there you are. It's incredible how good-looking you get about midnight, isn't it? Good-looking, well-built, intellectual and wealthy. Got a $30 smiling Frankie Gordon suit on. 50 cents worth of chili right down in front of you there, huh? You smell bad and you can't talk and you mumble, you know. Can't even order a drink, can you? Slide off the bar stool, go to the men's room, maybe it's a pay toilet. No money. You gotta slide under the door, huh? I'll bet there's some door sliders here tonight, huh? And then you slide out again. Never knew till I got to AA. Once you got in, man, all you had to do was turn the handle and walk out. But not the alky, the hell with it. Slide in, slide out, right? And then you wander around outside trying to find your car. That's the ultimate end. Walking miles about, can't find your car. Call home to your wife, you took my car, didn't you? Geez, I think one of the highlights of the alcoholic's life is the night he finds his car. It's kind of a spiritual experience, isn't it? You're walking down the street, there it is! It hasn't been impounded, God love your car. Open the door, get in, go to bed, right? Huh? And we laugh a great deal about all these things tonight, don't we? But when we were walking down that road, when we're going through it, nothing's funny. Nothing's funny. Because I'm grinding up every loving thing I own. Every loving thing that means anything in my life, that whiskey's getting. The respect of the people I work for, I do business with, it's gone. The old Yugoslavs, they sold out in 1951. An Eastern firm pulled in. They took over and they changed the environment. Image was big, education was a must. They even said they would pay for it. Go tonight, we'll pay for it. Pay for your time, pay for your tuition, books, mileage. But at 51, I haven't got any time. In 51, I can't live with it or without it. I'm coming from behind all the time. It's all I can do to stay even out there. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, they need me. They'll never let me go. I'm the guy that makes a run out there. I drive the line. Yeah. And now I'm getting in a lot of trouble. I'm starting to miss the budgets out on the jobs. And then I'm in a hell of a jam down in West Texas. We had a 90-mile line went from Odessa to Big Spring. And I'm a bad jam. It was so bad after I paid the fine, they drove me down to Midland, put me on a plane, sent me back to L.A. and said, don't ever come back to West Texas again. And then they called the company and says, people like him we don't need. And then the company calls me in and say, we don't need people like you. And the next time we ever smell booze on your breath, boy, you're through. You drink too much. You're ruining your life. Get out of my office. You'll never do an outside job again. Not for us. Get out of here. The humiliation, huh? We could write volumes about it. We've been humiliated so many times, huh? How I want to reach over and grab him by the throat and grab him by the throat. Who the hell do you think you're talking to, man? You Johnny come lately? I make a go out the backbone of the division. But I don't tell him anything. Because I'm frightened. These are the things I told the guys in the gin mill that night, though. Oh, I told him, did I tell him? I told him I'm going to quit. And he said, don't do that. But I didn't tell him. Up here, I said, I'm leaving him. I'm owning my own company. I'm going to run him out of business. That jerk's going to have to come down to see me for a job. He's going to walk in my office, and I'm going to say, get the hell out of here. I remember you. And then I had another drink, and I dreamed another dream, and I slid off another stool. The respect was gone. The respect of the people I worked for and did business with. And then one day, I'm driving into the house. I've been gone a couple of days again, and I'm scheming, and the Alky is a schemer. One more lie, one more promise, you know, Red, let me in. How many times have I stood there and, you know, with the tears coming down, going, baby, Jesus, give me a break. Don't throw me out. Hell, think of the kids. I'm going down and see that new priest down there. I'm going to take another pledge, baby. That's what it's going to be. You wait and see, it'll be all right. And I'd scheme and I'd get in, and then I'd start scheming to get back out. Yeah, and then this day she says, and she's not even sore. She says, Norm, you're a drunken bum. Hell, you'll never live to be 35 years old. You're drinking yourself to death. I'm an erotic because of you. Look at the kids, they're erotics. I spent the major part of my life just sitting there looking through the front room window. Wouldn't see a car come home night after night after night. I wouldn't see it come in. You don't come in, I die. I hear a siren scream the streets and I die. No more. I call an attorney. I've asked for separate maintenance. I put a restraining order against you. You don't set foot on the property. I file for divorce. You're out of my life. I'll always love you. But you tore out all the feeling, Norm. I just don't have any feeling for you one way or another. And so you throw a few things together and you walk out and you get in the car and you drive away. And you make that profound statement that each and every alcoholic makes that's in this position. I'd say, why me? Why the hell did I do it? Why is it that I go 3 days or 2 days? Why? I'm not that bad. Look at this bum, Charlie, don't even work. Always this. You know what I know, huh? You're an alcoholic and you drink enough booze long enough and hard enough, it's just a matter of time till you grind it out, isn't it? Just a matter of time till you stand there and you're tapped. Sure, there's cases where people stick around for 20 years. Oh, he's hoping that jackass is going to straighten out. 20 years of watching him flop in and out of the house. 20 years of picking up the pieces. 20 years of lying. 20 years of promises you can't make. 20 years of saying to friends and relations, don't come over. Norm's got the flu. He flew under the beds when he flew, huh? Hell, I wouldn't put up with it 20 days, let alone 20 years, but there's people out there. God give him a lot of strength. I don't think he did him any favor, but he gave him a lot of strength, and they hang in. And the guy comes to a meeting, and she comes with him, and they walk through a door. And the guy's hung out. And he looks bad. And she don't look too good. And then they see the same couple 3 or 4 months later, and they're walking through the same door, and they've been going to meetings. And the guy's kind of sharped out a little. His eyes are clear. And you look at the woman, and in her eyes is a story. The story says, I've been waiting 20 years for this to happen, and finally it's happening today. We're happier than we've ever been in our life. A unique miracle that we choose to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish to God I could tell all the new people here tonight that's the way it's going to work out for you, but that isn't what we have to offer, you see. Sobriety and a way of life, that's what we have to offer. No more and no less. But you got to get down to the point where there's nothing left. I don't mean financially, but nothing left within yourself. The respect of yourself as an individual goes. I don't think it was a guy or a woman walked through that door that still had any grain of self-respect left. I think that was gone. You stood there in front of the mirror one day and you take a good hard look at you and what you see you can't tolerate. I don't go to gin mills anymore that's got mirrors in it because I don't want to look. And one day, it was February and it was 1954, and I'm laying on the floor. And I've been on a hell of a tear. And I got up off of the floor and I walked in and I picked up a telephone and I got a hold of information and I asked for the number of AA and they gave me the central office in Los Angeles. Thank God for central offices, huh? Because without central offices, why, people like me just wouldn't be here today. I called the LA central office, and the guy by the name of John C., hell of a guy. He answered the phone, and I said, do you know a guy named Sullivan? He said, what's his first name? And I said, I can't remember. He said, you've got to be kidding. He said, man, we got hundreds of Sullivans in AA. It's an Irish allergy, boy. I thought you knew that. And he couldn't help me to locate my friend, but he said, I'll tell you something now. If you got a drinking problem, son, you never have to take another drink again if you don't want to. Alcoholics Anonymous is an answer to your problem. Give yourself a break. Write down these phone numbers I'm going to give you. Call them. They'll be out to see you. And so I wrote down the numbers, and I started to call. And I got a hold of a guy, and he came out. And now the sponsor that I got a hold of happened to be one of those old hard-hearted sponsors. Went to school for hard-hearted sponsors. I used to think they sent him to L.A. to be a hard-hearted sponsor. Now, his attitude about the program was that if you wanted AA, you had to want it as bad as you wanted the whiskey. And if you didn't want it that bad, what are you doing here? Yeah, any length to get it. Any length to get the whiskey, any length to get the program. He said, I'm going to tell you something flat out now, boy. You need us, and we don't need you. And don't ever forget it. Don't forget it. And he said, if you think I'm going to pick you up and take you to me, you're crazy. He said, if you got a car, you drive. You got a car, what the hell are you doing in AA anyway? Yeah. But he said, here the last couple of years, you'd be surprised. We softened up a great deal. We've been taking chances on guys with cars, and they're making it, by God, some of them, yeah. But he said, if you haven't got a car, you can take a bus. And if you haven't got the bus money, you walk. He says, how many miles did you walk for the whiskey? Well, you can walk for the program, and it's a better deal. He said, I'm going to be down at a meeting called Temple City. It meets in Rosemead. He said, I'll be down there tonight, and I'm going to meet you there in the parking lot. And I'm going to meet you in a couple of more meetings, and I'm going to introduce you around. I'm going to get you a lot of phone numbers. And he said, bring $350 because you got to buy a book. If you don't have a book, you ain't going to make it. Now, all this he laid out. And I'm not saying it's right, but I'm not saying it's wrong either. I'm only saying that's the way the program was brought to me. And so that night I went down to the meeting. I went there in spite of him. I went there in spite of myself. I went down there because the old shooter upstairs didn't snap that angel off my shoulder. I went down there because I was curious. Maybe I wanted to hit him with my car. I don't know. There was a lot of reasons. Who knows? And I got down there to the meeting and I pulled in the parking lot, and there he was. And he walked up and he opened the door and I got out. And he put his arm around me and we walked in. And I loved that guy from that day till the day he died. And that guy was very controversial. He carried a terrific message. He was a tremendous speaker. He helped thousands of people out there. God knows how many people he helped. But he had a very difficult time in helping himself. You see, he wanted to be the director. He wanted to be the guy that told everybody how to run it. Tolerance, that God-given quality, says let another man live his life the way he wants to live it. Let him work his program the way he wants to work and not the way I want it. He couldn't do that. He couldn't surrender. He couldn't turn his will and his life over to the care of anybody on an all-time basis. Chapter 6 was for everybody else, but not for he. And so the ultimate end was that he got resentful, and the resentments ate him alive. And he went back out after 8 years. And he tried to come back to see us from time to time, but his ego wouldn't let him stay. The killer of the alcoholic, the ego, wouldn't let him stay because he couldn't forget he was the guy that carried the message. He couldn't forget that. And he says to me, he says, Norm, all the guys that I sponsored are now my sponsor, Norm. And he'd go back out. And he stayed out there down there 12 years. And then he had a severe heart attack. Drove him to his knees. Physically, he couldn't get any more whiskey down. He came on back to see us, and he spent a year and a half. And then he died. And he was a hell of a guy. And he was the greatest sponsor that I've ever seen, because he's the guy that took the time to come to see me on a busy Sunday afternoon. They met me down there at that meeting and took me in there and introduced me around to all them guys. Got them phone numbers. Drank that rotten coffee. Listened to everybody talking at the same time about different things and everybody interrupting everybody. You never got to hear the end of nothing. They keep telling you, keep coming back. And you're sure if you do, you'll hear the end of something around here, by God. Yeah. And this old Temple City meeting was an extremely wealthy group. We had so much money in the group in those days, we had donuts before and after the meeting. Can you believe that? We had them red jelly donuts. We didn't have them cheap Jack plain donuts. Red jelly donuts. They were good eating. They're good for new people. You see a new guy come through the door and he's all green and hung up. And the red jelly donut committee would slide up on him. Yeah. Nice to have you here. You're new, aren't you? Would you like a donut? Oh, Jesus, yeah. Did you ever look at a red jelly donut when you got a hangover? It'll make your teeth itch, I'll guarantee you. Looks like something you left on the street last night. What it looked like, yeah. And then the meeting began, and the guy stood up in front of me, and he proceeded to tell everybody what a jackass he was. Talked about the number of people knocked the hell out of him, all the jails he'd been to, and people laughed. He talked about drinking something called Jamaica ginger and to give him the jake leg and to cripple him up so bad to put him in a hospital for 2 months. And they were hysterical over the fact the guy couldn't walk. My sponsor sitting there going, did you hear that? Yeah. You know how them sponsors, they got it. They're nut got it. Here, here, here. Yeah. They think you're deaf. They got you in the front row and they knocked the hell out of you all night. Listen to that. No, you're not deaf. I hear the whole damn thing. And I get to thinking, you know, I'm underqualified. Man, I really haven't been around. Compared to this guy, where have I been? My God, this guy's been in 70, 80 jails. I've been in 25 at the outside. I drank a little Vitalis and Sneaky Pete when I was in the Navy. But other than that, you know, I really hadn't been there. And I'm thinking, I better get back up. I got a lot to do out there. And then the guy makes that very profound statement. He takes it out of the book, doesn't he? Doesn't make any difference what you drank or where you drank it or how much you consumed. It's what it's doing to you. He said if it's tearing up any part of your life, you don't have to go any farther. And I sat there and I thought, yes, my friend, it sure has. I'm not so sure I want to quit the booze, but it's tore the hell out of my life. I'm so tired of hurting myself I could just spit. I'm tired of people knocking the hell out of me and going to the jails. People calling me up and saying, don't come to see me anymore. Or calling me up and saying, get me the money, boy. Get it in fast. I'm tired of hiding in doorways because I can't stand to see the guy coming up the same side of the street. I'm tired of hanging my head when I talk to people because I can't look anybody in the eye. And I'm tired of that. And I looked at that man that night, and the one thing I knew, past a shadow of a doubt, that I never had to live that way again if I didn't want to. How do you know that? You know. You know because AA is a program of example. There stood a street man out of L.A., 9.5 years sober, he's an example. He's clean and he's sharp and his eyes are clear and he's happy. What he is speaks so loud I cannot hear a word he says. By example. Boy, and he's dressed good. He's got himself a set of threads, probably cost him 100. And I'm thinking to myself, if he didn't get anything else out of AA, what a set of drapes. Boy, that's all right. I just might hang in a while. Maybe they got another issue going down. There was a couple of marks there could have been hustled. There was a lot of potential in that group. And I'm thinking, yeah, I just might stick around a while. And then the guy says, if I can do it, you can do it. And I'm thinking, maybe he's talking to me. And I'm thinking, yeah, maybe I could. What the hell? My life isn't that bad. To compound all these problems, this woman had divorced him and remarried. And these kids all hated him. And then one day, he bought the package of the program. And he had a change of attitude. And these kids came down to see him. And they learn to like him, to respect him, and to love him. And I look around, and what do I see? I see the miracle of miracles. I see the big tough guys, 190-pound tough guys in AA, sitting there. And the tears are streaming down their face. And the Hayshakers out of South El Monte and Garvey Acres, Wilmar, the tough ones, sitting there, and they're crying for the joy of it all. And the story was told, and I've heard the story so many times since, that they would laugh because they were miserable and they cried because they were happy and they called it AA. And you may say that's oversimplification and it may be, but it's the only program I got. You see, I discovered through the laughter of the program that I could clear out the wreckage of my past. That I could take 1,000 pounds of guilt off my back and I'll lay it down. Through the tears, I discovered a way that I could feel. That I could help. That I could give. As a man says to me, my sponsor, you didn't buy it, you can't sell it. You can only give it more. To give. And there's room, you see, for all here. You pick up the ashtrays, the coffee cups. You make the coffee detail. You're politically inclined, we run you for secretary and guarantee you the job, Norm. That's the kind of guys we are here. Or you make a call on the guy on the street out there that's hurting. And you sit out there with him in the middle of the night, giving away what you found, and it comes back tenfold. And he's taken to a meeting, and the guy gets it. And a year later, he stands in front of a group, and the reward is insurmountable. The sense of well-being that you found in the whiskey you're going to find here. The sense of well-being of sitting in an audience and seeing a guy a year sober, getting a cake and looking out there and seeing his, there he is, there it is. It's my sponsor. He saved my life. Without him, I wouldn't be here. And you get welled up with a sense of well-being that is insurmountable. And the tears burn your eyes, and you don't hold them back, and you let them go because you're unashamed. A sense of well-being that I look for all my life. I found it here. And when I woke up in the morning, the buzz is gone. And in his place is that old friend of mine. You remember him? Remorse. What do you say, Norm? You jerked my guts out, didn't he? Yeah. And then I drink a little whiskey. I didn't have to remember. Didn't have to think. And I was restored to that sense of well-being. And I traded that in for the sense of well-being I found here. And all I've had to do is be willing to give a little for the hell of it and want nothing in return. It's a marvelous experience. As I look back now, and I'm nearing another birthday, and I always kind of look back, and I remember, you know, that I almost kicked it all out. For you see, the second meeting I went to was almost my last. When that meeting was over with the Temple City, and my sponsor said, Norm, I'm going to a meeting in Pasadena tomorrow night. And I remember saying, you're kidding. And he said, no, I always go to Pasadena. I said, Pasadena's a rotten town. They must have some other meetings. And he said, I'm going. If you want to go, I'll be there. If you don't want to go, don't go. So what the hell, you don't think I can go? So I'll go. And I was a little nervous. Always I was nervous when I crossed the city limits. I got in there. I used to think of an alarm system went off. I said, giddy, he's there. Feel. But I got in there all right, by God. And I pulled into the meeting. And this meeting was one of those old-timers meetings you hear about in AA. They call it the Villa Street Group, the Mother Group. Had to be sober 10 years to read the steps. The speaker that night was an old-timer. He'd been sober 137 years. Yeah. I got to love this guy later on. But this guy, when he spoke, he always showed a picture of himself. It was a great big blown-up mugshot taken him when he was doing time in the county jail. And the point that he tried to get across was he tried to, you know, look at me when I'm drinking. And look at me now. And I looked at that picture, and I looked at Artie, and I thought, Christ, he looked better drunk that guy did, yeah. And this age is the hell of these buggers. I gotta get out of here. And I remember, you know, the next day on the way to work, I'm going down Arrow Highway, hit the town of Irwindale. Tony's Liquor Store's over there on the left side. That car just pulled right in, been doing it for years. I walked in, and it was Tony, baby, give me a pony. And she did, and I took it out of the car, and I broke it. And I took a long drag. And I threw it away, and from that day to this, it hasn't been necessary to take a drink. God moving in strange ways, because I never threw any whiskey away in my life. One other time that I remember, I was at a junior college game in the Rose Bowl. And I was down in the men's room, and I'm tilting one up, and in walked a policeman. And he said, in the can or in the can? And I remember saying, can we arbitrate this a little? And he said, oh, no, oh, no. And I poured it out, and I remember the tears coming to my eyes. The only other time. And my sponsor said, I want you to go to 3 meetings, and I guess I didn't want him to think I couldn't get to 3 meetings. And the third meeting I attended, well, I met a half a dozen guys, and they were all about the same age. And he said, we go to meetings Friday night, we always go down to South San Gabriel. Why don't you come on down? And I walked into South San Gabriel, and as I'm going through the door, a guy was standing there pinning names on him. It was a guy named Don that I'd done some a lot of drinking with 3.5 years before. He says, Norm, where the hell you been? I've been waiting 3 years for you. And I says, Donnie, I thought you were dead. You never could handle your booze. You know? And the turning point is there. And he was part of the group. And that same meeting, a couple of months later, I'm sitting in the meeting, and a guy gets up in front of the group, and I couldn't believe what I was looking at. It was a guy I did a lot of boozing with up in the valley. We had a lot of pipelines going in the late 40s. It was a guy that, he was a crane operator and a heavy-duty mechanic. His name was Frank. And Frank was really one of the worst drunks I'd ever been around. He was so bad that I couldn't drink with him even when he was buying. That's how bad he was. We called him Rotten Frank. To give you an idea how bad he was, he got 86 out of the Tulare Hotel for life. Now, anybody knows anything about the Tulare Hotel? It was so bad they burned it down a few years ago. That's how bad it was. Nobody got kicked out of the Tulare Hotel. Well, here was old Rotten Frank up in front of the meeting that night. And a woman's coming out of the door, and she's carrying a cake. He's got 3 candles on, and he leans down, and he blows them out. And he looks out there at the audience, and this guy's big. He's 200 pounds if he's an ounce. And the tears are streaming down his face, and he's crying, and he's all choked up, and he says, man, I've never had it so good. And he sat down. And a thing came over me like nothing I can ever remember. I got so choked up, I thought I was going to die. I didn't want to cry because I thought somebody might see me. I let him go anyway, and I cried unashamed. Not because I was miserable, not because I was sorry for anything, but because I was happy, because Frank was so happy. And I wanted to get up and say, Frank, tell me again, just how good is it, Frank? I had a feeling, a sense of well-being, and I've had 100 cents. And I'd like to tell you that every day's a holiday and every meal's a banquet. But that isn't the guarantee here, as I made mention. Sobriety and a way of life. And whatever you are, my friend, you're going to be better at. As my sponsor said, he says, Norm, if you're a ditch digger, buddy, you're going to be a better ditch digger. We don't guarantee you're going to make a ton of scratch or drive a big iron or live in the big house on the hill or Red's ever going to call you home. No, you're going to be better. Yeah. And you're going to be able to stand out there and you're going to be able to face it. When the days get moldy out there, you take the good days, Norm, you got to take the bad ones, the heartbreak, the grief, and the misery. It's part of the action. And you got to stand there and you got to hang in. You got to be like everybody else, Norm. And those are the tough days, and I'm the first to admit. I don't like the heartbreak, and I don't like the grief, and I don't like the miseries out there. I don't like them bad days. I don't handle them too good. I've been through some. Unfortunately, I suppose we'll go through some more. It would seem to be that God brings them all down to make people like me a little stronger, maybe what's coming later on. I really haven't got the background, the education, the understanding to understand things of this nature. I know that I've seen some. I recall in 1962 I had a moldy ear and I couldn't hit a lick and everything I touched turned to pucky. And I remember standing out there in front of St. Luke's Hospital. Emergency, I got called back, I was out of state. I remember seeing the doctors and walking back out. And I remember standing there and I remember crying. I remember saying, Christ, why me? Why did you have to do this? Why'd you take the boys? Christ, why you had to do it? And I didn't handle it very well. And I never do. I forgot to remember the essential of who the hell I was and where I came from and what it took to bring me to that point in my life. So if you think it's bad now, why don't you remember, Norm, when it was tough? Why don't you remember the year of 46 when you had to kill those people? But for the grace of God, you didn't kill four people. Remember 51 and you lay in the tank in Big Spring, Texas, and the cockroaches are running over your head. You're laying on a dirt floor and they don't bring you nothing to eat for 3 days, huh? Those are things you had to give up when you came to AA, Norm. Yeah, those are sacrifices you had to make. If you think it's tough, you better remember. And you better also remember that the old man upstairs never gives you more than what you can pack. That he cuts everything to size. That he gives the big loads to the big horses. And the small ones he's always given a guy's name, Norm. Instead of standing around crying a poor mouth about what you didn't get or what you did get, you better learn to say, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the day. Thank you for what you gave me. Thank you for today. Thank you for the opportunity to be out there. Thank you for the almost 28 years you let me walk out there on the sunny side of the street. For I know guys that died and never saw 28 days. For they walked the street of booze and fantasy, busted dreams and broken hearts and tears by the bucketful. The guy that brought the program to me, old Sully, in 46, huh? The first guy that ever told me about it. He had 3 years and he went back out and he flipped in and out. And then one night several years ago, his sister-in-law called me. She's on the program and she says, Norm, this is Ginger and I hate to tell you, but Sully was drunk this week and you don't need to worry anymore because he had an internal hemorrhage and he bled to death. And that was the end of the story. And she says, Norm, will you come on down and be a bearer, a pallbearer? I can't find six to pack the box. And I thought, what a hell of a way to go. A guy in his 40s and he can't wrestle six friends. How overpaid am I, huh? How overpaid. How very fortunate am I. He went out as hard as they go, with the heat on and the screws down, and he had to justify his existence to the bitter end. And I haven't had to justify my existence to anybody. I've been able to be out there and participate. I've been able to be a man on the street and do a job and do the best I can do with the equipment that God gave me. Be able to finish up a day and go home and walk in a house where I live. And in the house is a woman, and she's my woman. And she's a redheaded and an Irish woman. And she's glad I'm coming in, most of the time. You know, she respects me because I'm her old man. And nobody cries in my joint today because her old man is drunk and tearing it up. And I haven't heard a kid of mine scream at me for a long time. And I've had the opportunity to raise them up from small ones to big ones. I sent some of them to some schools if they wanted to go. Not that I'm an advocate of higher education, but I told them if you want to go, I'll do all I can do to help you get through. And I got two sons that are my business partners today. And I've got daughters that I've taken downtown one by one by one. I bought them the first pair of high heel shoes they ever put their feet in. And that don't sound like a hell of a lot unless you missed it, then you know what I'm talking about. I saw them go from the chickens of my life and they put on some shoes, different dresses. And they became the women of my life. And I cried because they're women. Because of women, they attract jackasses. You know that. In and out of the house. They've been coming for years. I still got one at home. She's 17. She's the caboose. And they're coming back through again. Only they're worse. Or I'm older. One come in a couple of months ago, I couldn't believe it was the worst I'd ever seen. Yeah, he walks in my house, and he's got his hat on. I couldn't believe it. And I said, Sonny, when I was breaking into houses, at least I would take my hat off, for Christ's sake. Is your head cold, boy? Get it off. My daughter was furious. I couldn't understand it. Yeah, we disagree without being totally disagreeable, you see. And I've walked her sisters down the aisle, one by one by one, and I tried every foot of the way, unashamed, knowing this jackass down at the altar down there waiting. I sent out invitations and people come. 70, 80 alcoholics all sitting in the church, and they're all crying at the same time. They know the guy's a jackass too, right? You can't fool them Elkie guys, I'll tell you that. But Alkies are very sentimental people. You know, we could go to the opening of the supermarket. We'd all cry, wouldn't we? But I'm really being a little hard on my son-in-laws. They're all working and taking baths. How the hell are you going to beat that deal, huh? I got a couple of drillers in the oil business. I got one's a dentist. I'm going to have teeth and gas any way you want to cut it. I got 5 granddaughters and a grandson. They come to my house and destroy it and take the knobs off my television. They put peanut butter in the slippers and they make me cry a little bit. They get to thinking about guys that never had the opportunity to see grandkids do nothing. And once again, I can say I'm overpaid. I wish I could tell you. I wish I could find the adequate words. How do you tell anybody that every loving thing you've got or any loving thing I'll ever be in my life is going to be because of AA? I can only tell you, buddy, if you're sitting out there new tonight, I'll guarantee you one thing. It's been a hell of a walk from the L.A. County Jail in Lincoln Heights to the point that I stand today. And but for the grace of God, Alcoholics Anonymous, and friends like you, I could have missed it all. Thanks, amen. God bless you.